Welcome back to the second part of The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is Diane Alston. She is USU's Extension entomologist, and we'd love to have your questions or comments, and our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. You can email us at zestygarden@gmail.com or go to the UPR Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Thanks for coming in, Diane. It's the beginning of a new growing season.
Yes, hope there's going to be some gardens ahead.
Well, I like the rain. I also love the snow, but I'm reaching that point in February where I'm going, okay, I'm ready to get out into the yard and get something done.
Well, and we are getting some much-needed moisture in the north here now, so yeah. Things are shaping up nicely.
So why are we talking insects at this time of the year?
Well, I don't know. You invited me in, Brian. Tell me.
But, so one of the things that prompted that was there's a from the Utah Plant Pest Diagnostics Laboratory and USU Extension, there's a publication entitled Utah Pest News. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to ask you about thrips, you know, because start talking about that. This one has a question and a section about onions and how thrips are devastating the farmers. So we have farmers that listen to this program, so why don't you talk about onion thrips?
Well, and there's many kinds of thrips, so onion thrips are just one type. The two most common that we have in Utah are the western flower thrips and onion thrips, and both of them have very broad host ranges. So even though onion thrips has onion in the name, it doesn't only attack onion. It attacks many ornamentals, flowering plants, most of the vegetables in your garden, you know, grasses, broadleaf plants. So that said, that's partly why they're such important insects, despite their little tiny size. But they can feed on a wide range of different kinds of plants. They reproduce rapidly at least for some of the species, they are reproduce asexually, and so it's just mothers producing daughters, and so it's they can develop resistance to insecticides more rapidly because of that behavior and high generation overturn. So lots of thrips building up quickly, and those are the characteristics that make them such tenacious pests. In addition to one other big thing, which is a number of them vector diseases, in particular viruses. And so the tomato spotted wilt virus, which we've had an increasing problem with in Utah in the last couple years, and then in the onion crop, they're dealing with a virus called iris yellow spot virus. And so there are two different ones that are causing quite a bit of widespread concern.
Okay, so I grow a lot of iris. Mm-hmm. Is this something I should be concerned about?
Well, the iris is susceptible to it as well. The symptoms on onion make these lesions on the leaves, and the iris also gets some damage on the leaves, but it's not quite the same pattern as you might see on onion. But it certainly harms the overall plant health. And so what it does in onion is it makes the bulb size smaller, and so you don't get as big of an onion. And so it's doing that to iris too. It's not going to kill your plant, you know, in 1 year.
But the rhizome might not be as big.
Right,
the flowers
healthy.
May not be as large.
Right. Okay. And so that's the concern. And the way thrips vector viruses, they do it by acquiring the virus from a plant that's already infected with the virus when they're young. And they basically ingest that. And then that virus actually replicates inside their gut. And then it comes and moves back up to their salivary glands. And so by the time they're a little bit older, then they've got the virus. And the virus is resident in them. So every time they feed on a different plant, they're injecting the virus into it. So that's called persistent propagative type of transmission, which is a tough one to battle. And also, when there's a plant that has the virus in it that they feed on, if they then lay their eggs on that plant, then the next round of offspring will acquire the virus and so on.
So do they have piercing, sucking mouth parts versus chewing mouth parts?
No, they don't exactly. What we call them are called punch and suck. And what they do is they just have one of their mandibles. So most insects have two mandibles. Those are the little chewing mouth parts. But in the case of thrips, they just have one of those, and it's modified into this kind of cone-shaped structure on the mouth that has a stylet that comes out and punches a hole into the tissue, while and then it laps up the sap or the
like
juice.
A mosquito?
Yeah, not quite, because a mosquito injects it more like as a proboscis and stays inside the plant while it's feeding, the mouth parts do, and suck out like a straw. Whereas this guy, it's punching a hole, or I should say girl, punching a hole and then sap, licking up ingesting, lapping up that the juice that's released, basically. So we call that punch and suck.
And are thrips overwinterers, or do they blow up on the winds like the beet leafhopper?
They are overwinterers, and so they do that as adults. So there's not many out there in the winter in terms of when it's cold. You know, they're not active, and they just find places to kind of hunker down and go into a low metabolic state. But there's plenty of vegetation out there in the agricultural landscape. It's crops like alfalfa that overwinter that are a good host. Some of the winter wheat.
Yeah, I noticed
wheat.
This article, it was saying where these crops like alfalfa, corn, wheat, low, there weren't a lot of thrips, where with alfalfa it was medium, common mallow it was pretty high.
Right, and so a lot of weeds that they'll overwinter on as well. And so they can even carry the adults can carry this virus in them throughout that winter too, and then have it, you know, the next spring and start feeding on more plants and spreading the virus that way as well too.
I'm imagining it's probably not too devastating for the home gardener, but when you've got a commercial enterprise and your onion fields are infected, that's affecting your bottom line.
It can really affect your bottom line.
So what do you do?
So insecticides have been the primary management tool because it's something that you can go and purchase, relatively easy to use. The downsides are that, well, number one, it doesn't kill them all, and so its effectiveness can be modest. It depends. You have to have a pretty heavy insecticide program to be really suppress the populations. But then you are prone to develop resistance in the thrips to the insecticides, so then after a while it doesn't work so well. So the other main things that we've been really exploring with this onion system is looking at ways we can try to make the crop less attractive to thrips. You're always going to have some out there, no doubt, but what you want to avoid are those really high populations, and then once they get the virus, that they're spreading it rapidly. So we do things like manage the fertility, and we found that where you have high levels of nitrogen applied, it actually makes the plants more attractive. They're darker green in color. They may be giving off different chemical volatiles. We've also speculated that it may be when there's lots of nitrogen in the tissue of the onion plant, it may also tone down some of these secondary compounds that actually are beneficial to the plant and fighting off, you know, making it less suitable for an insect to feed on. You can think about, like, you know, bitter tastes, things like in potatoes, the glycosides. Those are things that, you know, many insects don't like to eat, including some people don't like to eat. And so those are the kinds of compounds that lots of nitrogen can kind of overwhelm and tone those down.
Can you use like spinosad or BT on thrips?
Spinosad is actually a pretty good product. BT not. It is a selective for certain types of insects, such as caterpillars, and so it's not effective on thrips. But spinosad is.
Okay, so if you've got thrips in your garden, what's the easiest way to take care of those? I've noticed, we've talked about this before, I see them on my dahlias, the lighter colored dahlias they seem to go for.
So you want to have a good fertility program. I mean, in other words, you don't want to nitrogen starve your plants. So you ought to, you know, apply enough, but not too much. You don't want over fertilization. Also, plant diversity is helpful. So rather than having large plantings of one thing that then can be attractive to certain kinds of pests, thrips or other things, diversify. So break it up into smaller plantings of, you know, a little of this, a little of that. And even in the garden, you can do this by planting a few rows of something and then a few rows of something else. You know, you have to make it work within your productivity system, obviously, but more diversity, breaking it up, smaller clumps of different things, reduce the amount of pests, and not just thrips, but many insects that fly in looking for certain plants that they're attracted to. And then when it's more of array of different things, they have a harder time, you know, finding the ones they want, and you don't get as many.
Well, I wanted to turn our attention to talking about a new invasive species that hasn't quite made it to Utah, but it's on Utah's doorstep in Colorado now, and that's the emerald ash borer. And from what I've read on this insect, it's pretty devastating.
It's very scary, and it's bad in Boulder. I mean, by the time they actually realized it was there last summer at some point, it was already well established. And that's one of the real difficult things about this emerald ash borer is that it's we don't have a very effective trap for it. There are some traps. They're not that good. A lot of times the trees, when a tree gets infested, it's not obvious at first until you really start to see some of the decline going on, and by then it's heavily infested. So it's difficult to detect, and it spreads very rapidly. And so ash are the hosts and many different kinds of ash. And yes, it's not going to fly across the Rocky Mountains by itself, but it's being moved by people. And so once you get vehicles, materials, RVs, things like that, that can transport insects around really easily, it's likely to show up here in the not too distant future, unfortunately.
Where did it come from?
So it's native to Asia, and it was brought into the U.S. I guess Michigan was the first place where it showed up, around the Detroit area in 2002.
And it's already gotten this far.
Oh yes, west. And wow. It's killed millions and millions of ash trees now, from especially starting that north central kind of foci and down into the Midwest. And now coming toward the west. So, yeah, I mean, it's scary. I drive through the little town of Smithfield here in Cache County on my way to and from work, and it's one of those typical Utah towns that are lined with ash, these huge, large ash trees. And that's another thing, is that this borer attacks fully, mature, established trees, not just like young trees. And so... that kind of scenario may no longer, be really sad to lose those kinds of trees.
So if it's not Dutch elm, it's now the ash borer.
Yep.
And there's not really anything that can happen.
It's there. You can use some insecticides. The systemic types are not working well for this, but you can do preventive trunk sprays. But the problem is, oftentimes, by the time you realize that the insect is a problem in an area, there's a lot of infested trees. It's not a curative. It's not going to, take care of the insects that are already inside. So it's difficult to manage. Yeah.
What are the predators of this insect in Asia?
I'm not certain, but just in general, for flat-headed beetles, there are certainly some different kinds of parasitoids, little wasps that attack the larvae and the eggs. The adults are harder because they're a flattened, hardened, metallic beetle, and not too many insects or other things feed on those. Certainly birds, to some extent, would eat these, but it doesn't tend to be a major suppression effect.
Well, you're listening to The Zesty Garden. Diane Alston, USU's extension entomologist, is in the studio with me, and we'd love to have your questions or comments. The toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or you can go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and post your question or comment there, or send us an email at zestygarden@gmail.com. So as far as preparation for the growing season here, anything that we should be doing? I mean, there's snow on the ground, so not a whole lot. But I am going to be going out and doing some pruning.
Right. So this is a great time now to do your pruning of fruit trees and ornamental trees and shrubs that you need to clean up a bit. For fruit trees in particular, your goal is to open up the canopy a bit, so we get some sun penetration down in there to the lower limbs. You don't want it to have too heavy of limbs, and you want limbs that are at good angles to support fruit, not ones that are shooting straight up, such as water sprouts and things. So this is a good time to do that. And then is to think ahead the next little bit when we get to the point where we start to have some buds swelling and getting close to some early spring activity. Think about your dormant sprays. These are always a very effective way to go for suffocating insects that overwinter on the limbs of fruit trees and ornamental trees and shrubs. And so it's a very inexpensive and easy treatment because at that time you don't have all the leaves and things in the way to deal with. So getting yourself some Supreme type oil at your local gardening store called Dormant Oil and applying that just as the buds are starting to show a little bit of color, you know, some green tissue or a little bit of flower color showing. But before that comes out, that's the ideal time to do that.
And that could be St. George area.
Right. I'm sure that they're probably there on the brink of it right now. So
I know our listener it's in Beaver Dam, Arizona, would probably send, I remember him sending me a picture in February. That was a year or two ago. I'm like, this is no fair. These trees are breaking out already. So,
so
be on the lookout.
The almonds orchards are blooming in California right now.
Well, Diane, we've still got a few more minutes left with Petals and Prose, but this segment is done, and I appreciate you coming in.
All right. Thanks for thinking about early season insects and gardening.